Okay, just drums, no guitars at all.
Drum solo.
Okay. We're in a Doctrine of Salvation, Soteriology, Lecture 3. Lectures 1 and 2, we dealt with Anthropology, the Doctrine of Man. Now we're going to deal with Hamartiology, the Doctrine of Sin. So the key there is man was created perfect in God's image, and then he sinned, he fell, and because of that he needs to be saved. And so before we actually get into Soteriology, we're going to have to deal with Hamartiology, and I'm hoping to cover that in these two lectures here.
Is that pretty much spelled like a talent?
It's Hamartiology. It's from two Greek words, hamartia for sin and logos for word, or you can make it study or doctrine. So it's the doctrine of sin. The Old Testament words for sin and the New Testament words for sin, I like the job that Charles Ryrie did on that section better than your author, Miller J. Erickson. So I might have a few more words here, and some of them the definition might be given a little bit different than what Erickson gave. And so I'm just going to write them on the board, jot them down. I'll let you know if any of them are possibly going to be on the test. There's very few of these you're going to see on the test, but some of them you will.
Is that the basic theology of Ryrie's book?
Yeah. And if you want to also read similar chapters, the Doctrine of Sin, Doctrine of Man, Doctrine of Salvation, and Ryrie, that'll really help you. Old Testament words, there's chatta, which means to miss the mark. Chatta means to miss the mark. It's a lot like the New Testament word hamartia. The word ra means a breaking up, a ruin, and it's usually translated wickedness. Pasha, P-A-S-H-A, means rebellion or transgression. Rebellion or transgression. Awan, A-W-O-N, means iniquity and guilt. Shagag means to err or to go astray as a sheep or a drunkard might do. Now, I know a lot of you guys live sheltered lives, so you don't understand what it means for a drunkard to go astray. So just think about a sheep going astray, okay? So, Shagag, go astray. Asham, A-S-H-A-M, guilt before God that covers both intentional and non-intentional guilt. Rasha is wicked. It's the opposite of righteousness. It's the direct antithesis of righteousness in the Old Testament.
Does that have anything to do with Rosh Hashanah?
Well, what does Rosh Hashanah mean again? It's the Feast of Trumpets, isn't it? Yeah, no, I guess it would. It might be a variation because maybe there's the Jews in Hebrew. I have never had Hebrew, but you put one little line or one little dot somewhere and change the whole meaning of the word. So it could be a variation, maybe, but I don't know. Teah means to wander away, to go astray, and it speaks. It also emphasizes this is a deliberate wandering. Now those are the those are the eight main Hebrew words. There are other words for sin. Chatta, the missing the mark, would kind of you. Wouldn't be, it's not being all that God called you to be, okay? Pasha, the idea of rebellion. Shagag, the idea of going astray. The idea of wandering with Teah. So it's you start to get an idea about different ways of viewing sin from the Hebrew perspective. Now what I want to do is look at some of the New Testament words. Some of the New Testament words.
Well, I was aiming actually at the burn marks on the side, I guess. Did you really see
it? New Testament words, a lot of our Greek students will recognize these, kakos, which means moral badness, paneros, which means moral evil, asebus, which means godless. Enakos, or Enakos, well, whatever however you pronounce it, that would be guilty. Usually, it's guilty, and it usually denotes somebody whose crime is worthy of death. Hamartia, which is a missing of the mark. It's not completely without deliberation there, but for the most part, even if you try to be a good guy and you just fall short, even if you're shooting an arrow and you're aiming at the bullseye and you miss the 10 ring and it lands in the 9 ring, you might be happy, but you missed the mark. God demands perfection. Adikia means unrighteous in conduct. Now those who have in the Greek, remember the chaos is righteous, and so when you put the A in front of it, it just nullifies whatever the word is and it becomes the exact opposite, so it's unrighteous. Another one for our Greek students is anomos. Nomos is a law, and ah is, you know, not, so it's without law, lawless, yeah. So it's translated sometimes iniquity, but it really means lawless or without law. A guy who just doesn't go by the rules. Parabatis, it speaks of a transgressor. It's a transgressor.
Willful.
Yeah. Transgression would be more willful. Agnoin. Agnoin would be the ignorant worship of other than the true God. Ignorant, the ignorant worship of other than the true God, so it's ignorant idolatry is what it amounts to. But you're ignorant of the true God. The word gnosis for knowledge, the Greek word for knowledge is gnosis, and the I know is gnosko. This puts the A in front of it, so it means without knowledge of the true God, and the emphasis is on worshiping false gods. Planeo, is to go astray. Paraptoma is a falling away, a deliberate falling away. Hypocrisis means to interpret falsely, to pretend as an actor does, or to follow an interpretation known to be false.
Like a hypocrite, that's called interpret falsely.
And parabasis. Parabasis is to overstep a forbidden line. It's a transgression. To willfully overstep a forbidden line. Okay. So let me give you some of the words that would be that might show up on a test, not definitely, but they might show up on a test, or the other ones you really wouldn't have to know for sure. Kakas and Paneiros, the first two that I mentioned, you're definitely going to need to know. Well, you're not definitely, but you should know those two, and they could show up on a test. Hamartia. Anamas. And parabasis. In the Hebrew, I probably won't put any of them on the test. So I would say kakas, paneiros, hamartia, anamas, and parabasis would probably be the ones that that you'd want to study and get a good idea of, just in case we put them on the test. Now, with this background, what we now want to do is define sin. Obviously, these words come in sentences, and the sentences will give us a context of how they are used of man in his behavior, man in his attitude, and man in his nature. And from that, we need to define sin. Now, this is not a course in martyrology. It's not a course in the doctrine of sin. So we're not going to spend a real lot of time on this. So we just want to give you the conclusion of what would be a pretty extensive study to get a good definition of what sin is. But sin basically is a lack of conformity. In fact, you should memorize this word for word. It'll probably show up in the definer discussing. I want the definition. But sin is a lack of conformity. A lack of conformity to the law of God. A lack of conformity. The law of God in act, so that covers behavior, attitude, that covers inward motives as well, or state of being, and that covers our sinful nature. In other words, before we even sin, we are still sinful because we inherit a sin nature from Adam. So the state of our state of being is not conformed to the law of God. But also our acts and our attitude are also our behavior, our acts and our attitude, our motives, our inward thoughts. So definition of sin: sin is a lack of conformity to the law of God in act, attitude, or state of being. Now the essential nature of sin, the essential nature of sin, a lot of people try to pin it down as just one word, and some of those words cover about a large portion of what sin is. At the same time, none of them tell the whole story, and I think we need a combination of them, but selfishness is very key to sin. Putting yourself and your needs above anybody else's, putting yourself above God. Selfishness is very key. Now, it alone is not sin. There's more to sin than just that, but that goes a long way to describe it. That's why you can see a lot of the supposedly Christian psychology that's going on today is so off the wall, because all the emphasis is on yourself and you learning to love yourself more and more, and obviously that's going in the wrong direction. It's teaching you to be selfish. Another thing is pride. Very similar to selfishness, pride, where you overestimate your worth. And you see yourself as more important than others, and you see can't even see yourself like Lucifer did as more important than God. If you had to use just one word to sum up sin, I'd say it'd be this one. It rebellion against God. Rebellion against God. Another essential nature term that would describe essential nature of sin would be idolatry. Idolatry. Loving something, loving anything more than God. Placing anything above God, that is idolatry, and that is sin. And then five, perversion. Perversion or corruption of God's perfect creation. All I mean by that, I'm not talking about polluting lakes, even though polluting lakes isn't right. I'm talking about the fact that God created you to glorify Him with every breath that you have. To do anything less at any particular moment or second is to pervert God's perfect creation. And so when God says this is good, this straight line is good, when that line is perverted or crooked anywhere, corrupted in any way, then that is sin. So the essential nature of sin, know these five words: selfishness, pride, rebellion against God, idolatry, and perversion, because you'll get a real good understanding of the biblical concept of sin by the definition plus those five key words there. The origin of sin I want to cover three things. One is the philosophical problem. The philosophical problem of the origin of sin or the origin of evil. Number two, the origin of sin in the universe. And then number three, the origin of sin in mankind. The origin of sin in the universe is Lucifer's fall. The origin of sin of mankind is Adam's fall in the garden. Well, let's take a look first at the philosophical problem. The philosophical problem would run something like this. Well, not quite like that, but it would be everything that God created is good, or God created everything. Sin existed, therefore God must have created sin, or evil existed, therefore God must have created evil. That's the philosophical problem. How could evil exist? Now, some say, well, evil is an illusion, like the Christian Scientists, the Hindus. Evil and sin is just an illusion. It doesn't really exist. And you can still maintain an all good creation, even though they really wouldn't call it a creation, since God is the universe, in their thinking. Others would become what would be called metaphysical dualists. Dualists. D-U-A-L-I-S-T-S. A dualist would say, well, then therefore there must be a good God and an evil God that are co-eternal. and they're battling each other throughout all eternity. Otherwise, there's no way to explain evil. Can anybody tell me a great saint in church history that before he became a Christian was a dualist? If we had a course in history of philosophy, which I will be teaching a few months from now, then everybody would know it was Augustine. Augustine, when he was in the Manichaean cult, where and the problem of evil was the big thing that kept him from becoming a Christian. And finally, when he cracked that philosophical problem, that's what led him to become a Christian. And what he realized is you can't have two infinites because they would limit each other. And you've got to have some unlimited existence that is unlimited by any other existence at the top. So still dualism wouldn't solve the problem. It would just lead you further on to just push the problem further back. And so what Augustine realized was that sin, evil, everything God created was good, but that evil exists, and that the only way that evil can exist is as a perversion of that which is good, or a corruption of that which is good. In other words, evil is a privation. A privation means not just an absence of good, because let's say a sight is good, but the absence of sight in a rock is not evil, because rocks weren't meant to see. The absence of sight in a man is evil. I'm not saying the man himself was evil, but we have to admit evil circumstance. Yeah, because his eyes were created to see. So evil is an absence of a good that should be there. Sight shouldn't be in a rock, but sight should be in a man. So a privation means an absence of a good that should be there. A lack of a good that should be there. In other words, God, by giving man free will, which is a good thing, that means God created not the actuality of sin and evil, but the potentiality of sin and evil. By giving us freedom of choice, He created the possibility for us to actualize evil. But we're the ones who actualized evil. But we didn't create evil. All evil is like a parasite. It can only exist on something else. Without good, there would be no evil. Evil exists like rust on a car. Car manufacturers don't make rust. They make cars out of metal. But when the metal gets too wet over a long period of time, it begins to rust. So the rust exists as a perversion of the good thing. Okay? So you see what I'm getting at? So when God gave us the possibility to love Him or to not love Him, the movement away from loving Him is evil. So you guys see what I'm getting at there? It does not mean that evil is really non-existent. It means it's a real thing, but it's just a corruption. You know, it's like God made a straight line, which is good. We can't create anything. At the same time, He gave us the ability to take His straight line and make it crooked. And our making it crooked is called evil. Now, because the line really is crooked, evil does really exist, but it only exists as a perversion of that straight line. So you guys catching what I'm saying?
So you're saying that it's more man-made than God-made.
Yeah, but God's good creation is a creation. Our bringing about evil is not a creation, it's a perversion of the creation. Okay? So it's like I say, we just think of God creating a straight line and then also creating us with the ability to make that line crooked. We didn't create a crooked line, we just bent the straight line already. It'd be like God built a house, which is a good thing, and He built a sledgehammer, which is a good thing, but then He gave us the freedom to break down the house with the sledgehammer, our breaking down the house, it's a bad thing. So we actualized badness, but we didn't create it, because we still needed that potential to do that from God. At the same time, we're the ones responsible for actualizing that. God gave, you know, nobody goes around protesting free will, you know. Down with freedom. We want freedom put an end. We want an end put to freedom. Freedom is a good thing, but if you abuse it, that's called evil. And God gave us free will, so evil exists as a privation. So that's the philosophical problem. Evil. God did not create evil. He created man with free will, which is a good thing, but man abused that freedom by perverting God's creation and creating an absence of a good that should be there in all the situations where he's perverted God's good creation. In fact, that's why Aquinas, a lot of Calvinists misunderstand Aquinas when Aquinas says that man is not totally bad. They think he's denying their doctrine of total depravity when he really isn't. He would be closer to Calvinism than I would be. But what he actually means is, if there was absolutely nothing good left in the universe, then there would be nothing in existence. Because since evil is the absence of a good that should be there, for something to be totally evil would mean that all the good was taken from it. There'd be no evil can't exist on its own. It has to exist as a perversion of that which is good. If something is totally removed, all good is totally removed, then there's nothing left. There's no way to put the heat on in here, is there?
We could light that fire.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that'll get some heat real quick. The origin of sin in the universe was Lucifer's fall. Take a look at Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14. And verses 12 to 17. And I tell you what, John, if you could read that passage, and you could read it as loud, not as loud as possible, but if you could just read it loud enough for the cassettes to pick up on it.
How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Above 318?
To 17.
Okay. Those who see you will gaze at you, they will ponder over you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home?
Okay, now, when you look at this passage, one of two possibilities here. I tend to agree with those. Now the star of the morning, which literally can mean shining one, Hallel. I think it's in the Hebrew, but I think when they translated it to the Latin, I'm not sure. Anyway, the word, it turns out to be a proper name, Lucifer. In fact, if you read the King James, they just translate it as Lucifer. And so most see this as the fall of Lucifer, but then it talks about a man, and that seems to be the Antichrist. And so I would say this does seem like it is indicating, is pointing to. It's real tough to figure out. It starts out talking about the king of Babylon, but then it gets to the ultimate power behind him, Lucifer himself. But then it starts shifting and talking about a future king, reigning much like the king of Babylon reigned, but reigning over the whole world, and it seems like the Antichrist himself. But it seems to indicate, give some information about the fall of Lucifer. And what you see there is the five I wills. My will be done, a selfishness, a pride, a rebellion against God. You see idolatry, putting himself above God, and perversion of God's perfect creation. All 5 points from the essential nature of sin you see in there. Also look at Ezekiel 28. Ezekiel 28 verses 12 to 19. Ezekiel 28, verses 12 to 19. And Gary, if you could read that passage.
Chapter?
Ezekiel 28, verses 12 to 19. Again, God's talking to another king, this time the king of Tyre. And then all of a sudden, he starts saying things that the king of Tyre could have never done. And it becomes pretty obvious that he's talking about Lucifer. Okay.
Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre, and say to him, thus says the Lord God, you had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the ruby, the topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the lapilluzi, the turquoise, and the emerald, and the gold, the workmanship of your setting and sockets was in you. On the day you were created, they were prepared. You were the anointed cherub who covers, and I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. By the abundance of your trade, you were eternally filled with violence, and you sinned. Therefore I cast you as profane from the mountain of God. I have destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I put you before kings, that they may see you. By the multitude of your iniquities and the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuaries. Therefore I have brought fire from the midst of you. It has consumed you. I have turned you to ashes on the earth, in the eyes of all who see you. All who know you among the peoples are appalled at you. You have become terrified, and you will be no more.
Okay. Starts talking about the king of Tyre, but then he says you had the seal of perfection and full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. The king of Tyre wasn't created perfect. Then he says, God says, you were in Eden, the garden of God. That sounds like Lucifer. Then it goes down further. It talks about Lucifer on the day that he was created, but it refers to him as you were the anointed cherub. And cherub is a type of angel. And remember, the cherubim were placed to guard the entrance to the Garden of Eden to keep Adam and Eve from going back in there after the fall. So it appears that this is being spoken about Lucifer. I'd like to say something here, too. It looks like there's a threefold fall of Lucifer. In verse 16, where the last portion where it says, therefore I cast you as profane from the mountain of God, it's like God saying, okay, now you've fallen from your position of service for me. Then in verse 17, it says, I cast you to the ground, I put you before kings that they may see you. That seems like Revelation 12, halfway through the tribulation period, Michael the archangel and his angels kick Lucifer and his angels out of heaven. Lucifer still can go into heaven today. He does it in Job to accuse Job. He did it in the book of Zechariah to accuse Joshua the high priest. And he accuses the brethren right now, according to Revelation chapter 12, before the throne room of God. But Lucifer is going to be cast out of heaven halfway through the tribulation period. And then in verse 18, where it says, therefore I have brought fire from the midst of you, it has consumed you. I have turned you to ashes on the earth in the eyes of all who see you. It seems like there, either Lucifer either being thrown into the abyss for the thousand-year reign of Christ, or even after that, at the great white throne judgment, Lucifer being thrown into the lake of fire forever and ever. So the fall of Satan, don't get this idea that Satan's in hell now. That's usually what Satanists believe, and they believe he has this much influence over mankind, even being in hell, and that if enough people worship Satan and have enough human sacrifices, he'll be released from hell and he'll reign over man and give them their every bit of their sinful desires. The fact is, Lucifer roams freely right now, but the day is going to come when during the last half of the tribulation period he'll be limited just to the earth, and then after that, when Christ returns, he'll be chained up in the abyss, the bottomless pit, for 1,000 years. Then he'll be released, lead one final, his last stand against Christ. He'll be defeated, and then he'll be cast into the lake of fire, hell, forever and ever. But the fall of Lucifer, God's highest creation, his sin was pride and rebellion against God. It seems like he's led two-thirds of the angels to follow him in rebelling against God, according to Revelation chapter 12. When did the fall of Lucifer occur? Lots of guys will put it way back in the past, before millions of years before man was even created. I think that the fall of Lucifer, since that this passage says that he was in Eden, the garden of God, and still in his perfection, I think it might have been his decision to lead Adam and Eve astray. That might have been his fall as well as the fall of mankind. Okay? It was his decision to try to foil God's plans by leading mankind to follow his agenda rather than God's agenda, and I think that there's a good chance that that may be the fall of Lucifer himself. But the fall of the human race, sin entered the human race through Adam. Look at Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 to 7, and Wayne, I'll ask you to read that. Genesis chapter 3. Verses 1 to 7.
Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Indeed, as God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden." And the woman said to the serpent, "From the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat. But from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, lest you die." And the serpent said to the woman, "You surely shall not die, for God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate. And she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings.
Okay. And so this records the fall of mankind in the garden. Of course, God had given the command in Genesis 2, 16 and 17 not to eat from the forbidden fruit. But it's real interesting what's mentioned in Romans 5, chapter 12. Look at Romans 5, chapter 12. Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 5, verses 12 to 19. And John, if you could read that. Romans chapter 5, verses 12 to 19. And remember, Eve sinned first, but Eve isn't even mentioned here in this passage. If you could read that, John.
"Therefore, just as through one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin was not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam, who is the type of him who was to come. But the free gift is not like the transgression. For if by the transgression of the one, the many died, much more did the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abound to the many. And the gift is not like that which came through the one who sinned. For on the one hand, the judgment arose from one transgression, resulting in condemnation. But on the other hand, the free gift arose from many transgressions, resulting in justification. For if by the transgression of the one, death reigned through the one, much more those who receive the abundance of grace and of the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ. So then, as through one transgression there resulted condemnation to all men, even so through one act of righteousness there resulted justification of life to all men. For as through the one man's disobedience the many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of the one the many will be made righteous."
Okay. The Bible teaches real clearly that sin entered the human race through Adam, not through Eve, but through Adam. Yet Eve sinned first. And what that tells us is that when Eve sinned, mankind still had not fallen. Now, a lot of my professors, I don't think I know of anybody who ever agreed with me on this point, so I'm not going to be dogmatic on it. However, I do believe this is the clear teaching of a lot of different, when you put a lot of passages together, I think it's the only way to resolve it. I believe that we inherited our sin nature from Adam, not from Eve. That if Eve had sinned and had Adam not sinned, if Adam would have had relations with Eve, their children still would have been born without a sin nature, even though Eve would have had a sin nature. I believe the sin nature does not pass from our mothers to us, but from our fathers to us. Now, a lot of theologians, Erickson will slam it, and he does a lousy job slamming it. I've never heard a good job slamming it. But Erickson will slam it and act like it makes it like the sin is definitely in the flesh. I'll say two things about that. Number one, Paul always calls sin flesh, so it might be in the flesh. I'm not saying that it is, but maybe it's more than symbolic. But if just flesh just stands for human sinfulness, let's say this, the sin is in the soul. I also believe that our soul and our body, we inherit from our parents. We don't inherit, God doesn't create a soul in us at the moment of conception. Some theologians hold to that, but if that's the case, it would be an unfallen soul. Or either that, or God would create a fallen soul in us, but then God would be the one who's making us sinners, not Adam. What I'm saying is the view that I hold to, and I'm not going to be dogmatic on it, you won't even see it on the test, but the Bible clearly teaches we inherit our sin nature from Adam. Now, some Protestants say, well, that all that means is that if Adam hadn't sinned, God would have slain Eve and given Adam another wife, and it just doesn't sound like the character of God, which leads me to believe we inherit our sin nature from Adam. It's the sin nature is passed on from the man, which means if you ever had a man who was born of a woman without the agency of a man, you would have a man who would be born without a sin nature, which would explain why Jesus Christ was born of a virgin without the agency of a man, and lo and behold, he is born without a sin nature, yet, how do the Catholics try to explain it by saying Mary didn't have was conceived without sin? But then you could follow that back and say, well, then her parents had to be conceived without sin, and their parents, and then you would go on and on, and eventually you would have no sin nature being passed on from Adam. So the Catholic view is shaky. I've heard a Protestant view from Henry Morris, and I don't know if Erickson holds. I think Erickson suggests it, but doesn't hold to it. But Henry Morris said that no, God just put a fertilized egg in Mary. In other words, Mary was just a surrogate mother, and when it comes right down to it, Morris won't admit it, but his view would lead to the conclusion that Jesus wasn't really human. To be human, you've got to really be related to Adam. Now, if they figured out a way to take an embryo, a monkey embryo, and put it in the womb of a woman, so a woman would bring an ape to term, when she gives birth, she's only surrogate mother, it's really an ape. It's not really a human being. And so Jesus would be an alien if Henry Morris is right. I believe the egg of Mary was where Jesus got his humanity from, yet he was born without sin. Now some will say, most theologians will say, Protestant theologians, he got the egg from Mary, got his humanity from Mary, but there was a miracle that occurred there to keep the stain of sin. I think that the miracle is just the fact that you could be born without the agency of a father, but I think this explains a lot if we just understand that the sin nature passes on from the man to the children, both male and female children, but it's his male children that will then pass it on to the next generation. Do you have something to say, Gary? Okay. Okay, but that's the origin of sin with the universe and the origin of sin with the human race. In the next lecture, a little later, we're going to be looking at various views of the fall. But what I want us to do right now is look upon the consequences of sin upon mankind. The consequences of sin upon mankind. Well, what are some of the results of the fall and the fact that man is now sinful since we inherit a sin nature from Adam? I think what I'm going to do, rather than us look up the verses, I'm just going to give these to you real quick since we are running a little low on time. First, and I just put these in any order, by the way, not in order of importance. First is spiritual death. Spiritual death, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1. tells us we were once dead in our trespasses and sins, but then later God made us alive. Spiritual death. Spiritual death is defined as separation from God. Our spirits are separated from God. Romans 6:23 tells us, for the wages of sin is death. Okay, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord. Genesis 2:16-17, God said, if you eat from the forbidden fruit, from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you shall surely die. Spiritual death, but also physical death. Genesis 5:5 says, and Adam lived so long, and then he died. So man not only died spiritually, but physically. Death theologically means separation. Spiritual death, our spirits are separated from God. Physical death, our bodies and our spirits are separated. Like James 2:26, he says, the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead. So spiritual death, physical death, then shame and guilt. Genesis 2:25, Adam and Eve were naked, but they were not ashamed the way they were created by God. But then after they sinned, Genesis 3:7, they realized they were naked and they covered themselves because they were ashamed of who they were and they wanted to hide that from God. When we were created innocent and perfect, there was nothing to hide, nothing to be ashamed of. A cursed environment that would produce thorns and thistles, Genesis 3:17-19. Romans 8:19-23 tells us that all of creation is suffering from futility because of the fall of man.
What
number?
What,
let's see,